From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 107, The Largest Lime Works West of the Mississippi. Despite the fact that the origins of lime activities at Roach Harbor are obscured by a cloud of doubt, a lime kiln was probably located in the vicinity of English Camp on Garrison Bay, about 3 miles south of Roach Harbor in 1860, when Britain and the United States were jointly occupying the island during the Pig War boundary dispute. The lime kiln was operated by British troops under the command of Captain Basil Gett of the Royal Marines at the time. Many people believe that the British were responsible for developing the kilns at Roach Harbor, however, there is little evidence to support this. An American named S. Meyerbach attempted to curate a kiln in the vicinity of the British at Roach Harbor through the intermediary of William Brannock, but he was dissuaded by the American forces because the kiln fell under the jurisdiction of the British. It was some time after the 1872 settlement of the boundary dispute that made American laws effective that Joseph Roof filed a claim for the land enclosing Roach Harbor, and he was granted a patent for the area in April of 1877. Several times during the course of the next 2 years, the property changed hands. Robert and Richard Skurr, who had moved to San Juan as early as 1871 and 1873, purchased the land from Roof in 1878. A wood boarding house for workers was built by the Skurs in collaboration with the Canadian brothers Alexander, Colin, and Donald Ross, who were also involved in the project. Roach Harbor was transformed into the largest lime factory on the West Coast thanks to the efforts of John Stafford McMillan. McMillan was born and raised in Indiana before settling in Tacoma in 1882. During his time in the Puyallup Valley, he became interested in the lime industry, forming the Tacoma Lime Company in 1883 to serve the community. On the 31st of December, 1886, McMillan purchased the Roach Harbor land and works from the Skurr and Ross brothers. He then formed the Tacoma and Roach Harbor Lime Company and embarked on an extensive development program for the manufacturing process as well as the physical plant. A regional magazine called the West Shore noted on the works in 1889, when the new company took possession of the works 2 years ago, there were only 2 kilns of the large stone pattern, which were turning out about 8,000 barrels a year. A small lime shed, a manager's residence, 3 or 4 small buildings, and 3 log cabins for men. McMillan also extended the wharves, loading platforms, and quarries on the property, as well as building a cooperage, office, and storage facilities. His company's output was further increased by the construction of 3 additional kilns, one of which was of the older stone kind and 2 of which were of the newer monitor design, with boiler steel encasing the brick lining. The addition of Kiln Battery No. 2, a complex of 8 monitor kilns, in 1891 more than doubled capacity, increasing the total number of kilns to 13 by the end of the century. Production increased from 8,000 barrels per year during the Skurr period in the mid-1880s to about 150,000 barrels per year by the 1890s. Gravity played a significant role in the limestone quarrying and lime production processes. Vertical face limestone deposits upslope of the kilns were blasted to expose large boulders that were blown up and broken into smaller pieces for loading into the kilns. In order to shatter medium-sized rocks into usable chunks, usually 8 to 12 inches in diameter, a 9 or 12 pound rock hammer with a narrow bit was employed. Careful consideration was given to wasting the least amount of rock as possible in little chips. This kind of rock allowed the hot gases to circulate around the piles of rocks in the kilns, thoroughly heating them as a result of their size. Tracks were installed for more permanent rail lines and trestles to the quarry that was now being operated on using temporary 36-inch gauge tracks. Once loaded by hand into rail or trestle trains, and subsequently trucks, the rocks were transported by men, mules, or later 040 saddle tank locomotives to either stockpiles for shipping, where they were left unprocessed, or bins for burning in kilns to generate lime, which were left processed. Calcination, sometimes known as burning, is the process by which lime is formed. Limestone is heated to temperatures ranging from 1,650 to 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit in order to force carbon dioxide out of the rock, leaving only pure lime. This procedure takes place in kilns, which are vertical shafts filled with limestone that receive heat from fireboxes on the sidewalls. The first kilns at Roach Harbor, numbers 3 and 4, were built with an inner layer of fire bricks surrounded by stone and held by a framework of massive wooden timbers with a log cribbing hopper on top to hold the raw limestone. There were three neighboring kilns, 1, 2, and 5, as well as 8 in kiln battery number 2, 6 through 13, that were made of fire brick lined shafts enclosed in sheet metal, also known as boiler metal. There was a large chimney-like stack at the top of the structure, which was lined with a single layer of fire brick. In the middle, a short section tapered out to the heating shaft. In the middle of this taper, there was a hinged charging door, which allowed for the loading of stone from the bins into the heating chamber via chutes. The limestone was loaded into the top of the heating chamber in both types of kilns, and the finished rock was withdrawn from the bottom of the heating chamber every 4 hours. To remove the burned rock, which was still in decent chunks about 6 to 8 inches in diameter, long rods about 10 to 20 feet in length were used to rake it out of the bottom of the kilns and route it into a chute. From there, it would be loaded into barrels with its top shut to prevent the lime from rehydrating and becoming toxic. For consistency and product quality, the barrels were set on scales at the base of each kiln and filled with exactly 200 pounds of lime to ensure that the final result was consistent. As part of kiln battery number 2, the coopers who worked on a floor above transported the barrels to a packing area at the base of the kilns via ramps, where the removal of one barrel prompted the next to roll down and take up the position of the previous. In the 1890s, McMillan brought the operation a new form of barrel that is still in use in the industry today. Based off of a process devised by the Waterman Chapman Barrel Machine Company, machines were used to shave a thick veneer for the two sides of a barrel, resulting in only 2 staves and joints, as compared to a conventional barrel's 17 staves and joints. It was in 1891 that McMillan acquired the rights to use the technology, and a massive plant for manufacturing the new barrels was built on the eastern edge of the harbor to accommodate their output. When the barrels had been loaded with lime, they were hoisted onto flatbed carts on rails, which were hauled by horses to warehouses near the wharf where the barrels could be stored until they were ready to be sold. The fact that they were able to stack the hefty barrels 3 layers high was a source of tremendous pride for the workers. There was a fleet of ships called the Roach Harbor Lime Transport that operated on important West Coast trade routes such as the 3 to 5 day voyage from Puget Sound to San Francisco, or the Vancouver or Victoria Portland run. The Star of Chile, a huge Whitehold 3-master, the William G. Irwin, a 550-ton brigantine, the Archer, an Ironhold barkentine, and the Roach Harbor, a 60-ton steam tug. Ships laden with barrels of lime, some of which were heaped on open decks, were transporting a potentially extremely lethal cargo since quicklime, once wet, is highly flammable, making it terribly deadly. Attempts to put out a smoldering pile aboard the William G. Irwin, which was carrying a cargo of lime worth $30,000, took nearly a month, and even the Archer, which had an iron hull, was consumed by fire and sank with its cargo full of lime on board. Despite the dangers associated with shipping lime, there was a considerable and growing demand for it. In addition to being used as the primary mortar for masonry buildings, it could also be used to cover walls and other surfaces with a plaster finish. During the 1880s, the population of the Pacific Northwest increased by an astounding 165%, with the majority of the growth concentrated in 4 urban areas: Portland, Seattle, Spokane, and Tacoma. Between 1880 and 1889, the population of Seattle increased from 3,500 to over 43,000 people. By 1910, these 4 cities were home to over 1/3 of the total population of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho combined. In 1889, devastating fires in Ellensburg, Seattle, and Spokane prompted a shift in public perception of safety, which resulted in the development of new construction practices. Buildings made of brick and lime mortar were created in place of the wood structures that were readily destroyed by fire. This resulted in a significant increase in the demand for lime mortar across the Pacific Northwest and throughout the entire West Coast as a whole. Construction companies were increasing their usage of Portland cement, which contains lime as a crucial ingredient, at about the same time period. Although cement has been around for a long time, it was only in the late 1890s and early 1900s that it began to see widespread application in conjunction with reinforced steel rods. The minerals lime and limestone are also employed in the metallurgy and the production of paper, in addition to their construction-related applications. Quicklime was used as a flux in the smelting of steel and other metals to eliminate impurities such as phosphorus, sulfur, and silica, as well as manganese to a lesser extent. Smelters in Everett and Tacoma were among the region's major metal refineries. Both businesses later became part of the American Refining and Smelting Corporation, ASARCO. The term paper rock refers to the rock that was used in the paper-making process to process the pulp. Following the extraction of the higher-grade limestone from San Juan County, the remaining rock was mined for use in pulp mills in Everett by the Everett Lime Company and the Soundview Company, and Seattle, the Washington Pulp and Paper Company and Crown Zellerbach. Sugar plantations employed Roach Harbor lime as sugar rock in the refining process, which was used to make cane sugar. Lime was also employed as a fertilizer in sugarcane fields, where it was a good supply of nitrogen. Ships carrying barrels of lime for the sugar plantation sailed from Roach Harbor to Hawaii on a regular basis, according to records. Laborers at Roach Harbor came from a variety of nationalities, with a big presence of Japanese workers standing out among them. Young Japanese men were drawn to work in the industrial mining districts of the Pacific Northwest following the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act in the United States and the Meiji Restoration Act in Japan, both in 1882. At one point, Roach Harbor had as many as 24 of these Japanese residents. They sent men over to Japan in search of picture brides, and both single men and families were accommodated in a collection of 25 or 30 sheds at the head of the lagoon on the north side of the settlement, which came to be known as Japantown. Because they were familiar with pyrotechnics, they were frequently employed as powder men, as well as gardeners and domestic help for the McMillan family. There was an increasing number of other ethnic groups, such as Scandinavians and Russians, according to the 1910 federal census. Along with the quarries, limeworks, warehouses, and docks, Roach Harbor was home to a small settlement that included dwellings for McMillan and his family, as well as management and employees, a hotel, post office and store, as well as a church, school, and doctor's office. The Hotel de Haro served as a boarding house and mess hall for the locals. Apart from that, there were rooming houses for single men, including barracks and log buildings, as well as cottages for married couples. A small post office operated at Roach Harbor as a branch of the main post office in Friday Harbor, about 10 miles away on the island's east shore, until 1964. The company store, which was maintained by Thomas R. Kinsey, who was born and raised in England, was originally located near the waterside end of the dock. After a fire destroyed the pier in 1923, it was relocated to the land side of the newly constructed dock, where it's remained to this day. Employees were initially compensated in scrip that could only be redeemed at Roach Harbor, despite the fact that the store served not only Roach Harbor employees, but also residents on the north end of San Juan Island. Later, workers demanded cash payment, which was granted. McMillan constructed a Methodist church with a view of the port, which was also utilized as a school during the week by the locals. A second school structure was then constructed near the married men's homes to accommodate the growing number of students. Dr. Victor Capron, who came in 1898 and first lived in a house upslope from the hotel until subsequently using the property for his medical office after relocating to Friday Harbor, offered medical services for the community. Roach Harbor was frequently in the forefront of bringing technological advancements to the islands, as evidenced by the following. The new dynamo has arrived, and the cables are up for the new electric light plant to be erected at the lime kilns in order to light the works, hotel, and all of the company's functioning facilities, according to the San Juan Islander from the 21st of August 1902. A new diesel generator purchased in the 1930s, according to Wolf Bauer, an engineer who worked at Roach Harbor during the late 1930s, enabled the company to transition from machinery driven by flat belts and operated off a shared jackshaft to equipment driven by separate motors. In the early 1900s, McMillan intended to transform the entire enterprise into a cement production factory equipped with cutting-edge technology, but his attempts were thwarted by a lengthy litigation initiated by Ernest Cowell, which dragged on for more than a decade. John S. McMillan was a capitalist who fit the stereotype of a robber baron in many ways. The 32nd degree Mason was active in national political and fraternal organizations, having been an outspoken Republican, a founding member of Sigma Chi, and a member of the Order of the Eastern Star. Stories abound of McMillan pressuring his employees to vote Republican and terminating those who did not comply with his wishes. As a result, not only was the control of Roach Harbor workers' lives through their positions and earnings and working conditions, but they were also controlled through housing and the distribution of supplies at the shop. McMillan and his family enjoyed a comfortable but not extravagant lifestyle. They hosted enormous feasts at Roach Harbor and on nearby Henry Island, where they hosted tourists from Seattle and other nearby cities. His boat, the Calcite, accompanied him on trips through the San Juan Islands and nearby waterways, often in company with his friend Robert Butchart, who owned a lime plant on Vancouver Island and was a partner in the company. The McMillan Tomb, located near Roach Harbor, stands as the ultimate memorial to the McMillan era. A memorial to John S. McMillan's family, particularly his son Fred, whom he had groomed to be his successor in the firm, was the inspiration behind the mausoleum's construction. The design of the mausoleum, which consisted of a circular table around which six columns and six chairs were erected to hold the remains of the parents and their four children, was intended to depict the reunion of the family in the afterlife. To depict the incomplete life of man on this planet, a seventh place was set aside for a missing chair, and its matching column was planned and erected in a way that was broken or incomplete in order to represent the unfinished existence of man. It was also designed so that the sinking sun would cast a shadow between the chairs of the parents, John and Luella, while they sat in their chairs at the dinner table. Because of this, as well as the vivid, prolonged sunsets for which Roach Harbor was renowned and the golden hue of the columns, the mausoleum eventually earned the moniker Afterglow Vista. The initial design called for a bronze dome capped with a Maltese cross, which was meant to symbolize the Sigma Chi fraternity. Nevertheless, McMillan's surviving son, Paul Hyatt McMillan, who had taken over the family business from his father in 1936, the same year his father began designing the mausoleum, objected to the additional $20,000 cost and canceled the order, earning his father's anger in the process. In 1936, John S. McMillan passed away and his ashes were placed in the memorial that bears his name. Between the years of the 1920s and the 1930s, Roach Harbor had a series of difficult developments. On the 28th of July 1923, a fire engulfed the works, destroying the kilns, warehouses, store, and pier, among other structures. McMillan responded swiftly, and it appears that the kilns were up and running in a matter of days. He completely restructured the wharf, adding a new store, office, community center, and yacht club in the process. Production continued through the late 1920s and into the Great Depression, hitting rock bottom in 1933. A detailed examination of Roach Harbor's production statistics reveals that the company's output decreased during the First World War, at the start of the Great Depression, and throughout the Second World War. The year 1937 appears to be an anomaly, as it appears to have coincided with the construction of Grand Coulee Dam, the world's largest concrete structure at the time, so of course there was a massively increased demand for lime. By the late 1930s, the lime processing at Roach Harbor had not altered considerably in about 50 years. It was inefficient and labor-intensive, and as a result, it was no longer economical to continue operations. Added to this was the increase in transportation expenses, as well as a decrease in the number of ships that plied the waters of Puget Sound. Rail was the primary mode of transportation for freight heading for West Coast destinations. The fact that there was a market for agricultural lime in eastern Washington meant that it was packaged in sacks and transported from Roach Harbor to Everett, where it could be easily loaded onto rail cars. When his brother Fred McMillan passed away, Paul McMillan, who had previously operated the store in Roach Harbor, took over as vice president of the company. Paul McMillan was a brash executive who was notorious for carrying side weapons while in the company of his employees. After the firm refused to recognize the union, workers went on strike in 1938, resulting in the closure of Roach Harbor, which was the last lime plant in the United States to unionize. When the union leaders objected, Paul McMillan appeared in front of them with a shotgun and ordered the engineers and other management to take over the quarrying, burning, and loading operations. 3 months passed before the strike was resolved when customers informed the company that they would no longer purchase scab lime. Paper rock output decreased as a result of a steady change to paper rock manufacture during the 1940s and early 1950s. When the McMillans sold Roach Harbor to the Tart family in 1956, Reuben J. Tart, his wife Clara Diaz, and their son Neil Tart transformed the property into a resort and hotel. It was during this procedure that several of the kilns' metal structures, as well as the old warehouses, were torn down and recycled. Rich Komen and Vern Howard purchased the site in 1988 under the name Roach Harbor Resorts. In 1997, Howard sold his portion to Saltchuk Resources, which now owns the property today. It has been the responsibility of Roach Harbor Resorts to repair and stabilize the ruins of kilns 3 and 4, as well as the base of Battery No. 2, the Hotel De Haro, the major portion of the office and store, as well as numerous residences and employees' quarters. Together with the tomb, these facilities serve as a memorial to what was once known as the largest lime works west of the Mississippi, as the Roach Harbor sign proudly declares on its side. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include The Washington Standard, The San Juan Islander, The Pacific Magazine, The Everett Morning Tribune, The Journal of the San Juan Islands, The San Juan Island Historical Society and Museum, HistoryLink.org, Washington Rural Heritage, and the United States Census Bureau. Thank you for listening to episode 107, The Largest Lime Works West of the Mississippi. Episode 108 will be released next week. A special thank you goes out to Alan Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you once again for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next time, I'm your host, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets, and on the Hull. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck, the singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookumchuck, and Moclips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.